I've been a preacher for more than 30 years. I've studied and taught through the book of Genesis many, many times in churches all around the world. And I've trained pastors in the skills of interpreting texts. And it's very clear they're not stories about gods. They're stories about the powerful ones in the Bible and the sky people, the Anunnaki in the Sumerian tablets.
Yahweh and the other Elohim enjoy certain smells. And in order for the people to keep their respective Elohim happy, they have to provide them with certain smells. And so the smell of burnt oxen and the smell of burnt sheep brings great pleasure to these beings. Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, took their censers, put fire in them, and added incense. And they offered unauthorized fire before Yahweh, contrary to his command. So fire came out from the presence of Yahweh and consumed them, and they died before Yahweh. Moses then said to Aaron, "This is what Yahweh spoke of when he said, 'Among those who approach me, I will show myself holy. In the sight of all the people, I will be honored.'" Aaron remained silent. Now, straight away, I think we should ask, does that sound like the source of the cosmos? This episode of The Fifth Kind is brought to you by Ancient Knowledge Academy, a learning community for anyone interested in human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today. Though I get a lot of pushback from Christian believers about the things I write in the Eden series and the things I put out on Fifth Kind TV and on the Paul Wallace channel, I actually think that Christians ought to have a head start in recognizing that there is paleocontact in the Bible, narratives of contact with non-human beings in our ancestral past. And the reason I say that is because Christianity has a particular moral vision of God. When Jesus talks about God, he uses the Greek word theos, and the divine qualities he espouses are 180 degrees removed from the morality of the Elohim and Yahweh characters in the Hebrew scriptures. That ought to clue the Christian believer straight away that at least some of the Elohim and Yahweh stories are something other than God's stories. They are something other than revelations of the character of God. And so I believe Christians, when they read these ancient texts from the Hebrew canon, should be on the front foot in recognizing that we are being told about something else, contact with a different kind of entity in the deep past. There are so many examples one could choose from, but today I want to go to Leviticus chapter 10. Now, the background to this story is that Yahweh and the other Elohim enjoy certain smells. And in order for the people to keep their respective Elohim happy, they have to provide them with certain smells. And so the smell of burnt oxen and the smell of burnt sheep brings great pleasure to these beings. Now, straight away, I think we should ask, does that sound like the source of the cosmos? Does that sound like a transcendent understanding of God, the source of all things? Would the source of the cosmos need to inhale the smoke from burnt oxen or burnt sheep in order to be happy? To me, it suggests this is some other kind of entity who needs to be appeased or calmed in this sort of way. And so all through the scriptures, we have references not only to Yahweh, but to other Elohim who love this smell of burnt flesh, particularly burnt oxen and burnt sheep. But there are other times when other smells are required. And so very complex recipes are given in the scriptures to create these aromatic smokes that the Elohim, including Yahweh, liked. But what happens if you get the smell wrong? That's the story of Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus 10. Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, took their censers, put fire in them, and added incense, and they offered unauthorized fire before Yahweh, contrary to his command. So to clarify, when we get down to the Hebrew, this unauthorized fire that Yahweh had not commanded, what it's telling us is that they have got the recipe wrong. It's not that Yahweh didn't like smoke or this wasn't a good moment for him to have a smoke. They got the recipe wrong. There was something off in this fire or smoke that Abihu and Nadab bring into the presence of Yahweh. Look what happens when you get the smell wrong. So fire came out from the presence of Yahweh and consumed them, and they died before Yahweh. Moses then said to Aaron, "This is what Yahweh spoke of when he said, 'Among those who approach me, I will show myself holy. In the sight of all the people, I will be honored.'" Aaron remained silent. Moses summoned Mishael and Elzaphan, sons of Aaron's uncle Uziel, and said to them, "Come here, carry your cousins outside the camp, away from the front of the sanctuary." So they came and carried them, still in their tunics, outside the camp, as Moses ordered. Then Moses said to Aaron and his sons Eleazar and Ithamar, "Do not let your hair become unkempt, and do not tear your clothes, or you will die, and Yahweh will be angry with the whole community." So let's be clear what's just happened. Two of the sons of Aaron is the high priest, his sons are priests, have taken in an incense offering to Yahweh, but it wasn't strictly according to his instructions. They've got the recipe wrong. And so he has incinerated them to death in front of their father and in front of Moses. And when this happens, Moses says, "Don't say anything, Aaron. I told you he was like this. Go and get your cousins to get the bodies out of there. And they must not show any mourning," that's the tearing clothes and hair unkempt, "because that will offend Yahweh, and they will be killed as well." What's the purpose of this story? Is it a made-up story? Because very often, preachers like to say, well, the moral of the story is, tell me how you can get a positive moral out of this story. If it's a fiction that's been created to teach a moral, what is the moral you're going to teach from this? The overarching purpose of the canon is for the reader to love and worship Yahweh. Is that going to be the result from reading this story? I would suggest that if the overarching agenda is to get the reader to love and worship Yahweh, this is a deeply inconvenient story, because this will get the reader to despise and fear such a character. That's not the same thing at all. If the agenda is to get the reader to worship Yahweh, this is a deeply inconvenient story that would have been better left out. So we have to ask, why has it been included? If it's not a story that results in a positive religious imperative, if it's not a story that results in a positive moral lesson, I would suggest it's an inconvenient story that's been included because it couldn't be gotten rid of. In other words, it was a part of the cultural memory that, though inconvenient, had to be included because it was known. If that's the case, then it's a memory of something that is not God. Now, someone might say, but wait a minute, I believe Yahweh is God. And certainly, there are passages in the Hebrew Scriptures where the word Yahweh seems to be used in that way, when Yahweh is the ideation of the creator of the cosmos, when Yahweh is the recipient of worship. All sorts of grandiose and transcendent things are said about Yahweh. But I'm talking about these passages where Yahweh is an active player in the story. Because in this story, Yahweh does something. He incinerates people who've got the smell wrong. So where's the religious imperative from that? Where is the positive moral from that? And Yahweh is not the only Elohim who needs these smells. If we read the story of Bel and the dragon, which is a suffix to the book of Daniel in the Hebrew Scriptures, we see there that Elohim also needs the same smells of burnt oxen and burnt sheep. They're clearly made of the same stock. So I would suggest that there is no Sitz im Leben for this as a moral tale or as a story bringing a religious imperative. Bible scholars talk about the redaction of the Bible being organized by Yahwist, Elohist, Deuteronomist, and priestly authors. And they talk about the agendas reflected by these different layers of redaction. And so they say some of the editors, they've written this, they presented this story in a way that will endorse the kingship, the monarchy, the Jewish monarchy. Or they've written this in a way that endorses the Deuteronomistic laws. Or they've written this in a way that authenticates the priesthood. This story doesn't do any of those things. It is a picture of a terrifying, monstrous being who will incinerate people without mercy, without forgiveness, without warning, because they got the smell wrong. So I suggest this is an inconvenient story that's been included simply because it is part of the cultural memory. It has to be included, and it doesn't serve the monotheistic purpose of the canon as a whole. If you hold the view that Yahweh is God, and if to maintain that view, you find you have to call evil things good, that should be your clue to hit the pause button. And think again, if you're having to justify things you know to be evil and wicked to maintain that theology, there must be something wrong with that theology, mustn't there? So let's have a look at another example. 2 Kings chapter 1. After Ahab's death, Moab rebelled against Israel. Now, Ahaziah, the king, had fallen through the lattice of his upper room in Samaria and injured himself. So he sent messengers, saying to them, "Go and consult Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron. Go and consult Baal-zebub, the Elohim of Ekron, to see if I will recover from this injury." So he sent messengers, saying to them, "Go and consult Baal-zebub, the Elohim of Ekron, to see if I'll recover from this injury." But the messenger of Yahweh said to Elijah the Tishbite, "Go up and meet the messengers of the king of Samaria and ask them, 'Is it because there is no Elohim in Israel that you are going off to consult Baal-zebub, the Elohim of Ekron?' Therefore, this is what Yahweh says, 'You will not leave the bed you're lying on. You will certainly die.'" So Elijah went. When the messengers returned to the king, he asked them, "Why have you come back?" "A man came to meet us," they replied, "and he said to us, 'Go back to the king who sent you and tell him, this is what Yahweh says, is it because there is no Elohim in Israel that you are sending men to consult Baal-zebub, the Elohim of Ekron? Therefore, you will not leave the bed you are lying on. You will certainly die.'" The king asked them, "What kind of man was it who came to meet you and told you this?" They replied, "He was a man with a garment of hair and with a leather belt around his waist. The king said, "That was Elijah the Tishbite." Then he sent to Elijah a captain with his company of 50 men. The captain went up to Elijah, who was sitting on the top of a hill, and said to him, "Man of Elohim, the king says, come down." Elijah answered the captain, "If I am a man of Elohim, may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men." Then fire fell from heaven and consumed the captain and his men. At this, the king sent to Elijah another captain with his 50 men. The captain said to him, "Man of Elohim, this is what the king says, come down at once." "If I am a man of Elohim," Elijah replied, "may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men." Then the fire of Elohim fell from heaven and consumed him and his 50 men. So the king sent a third captain with his 50 men. This third captain went up and fell on his knees before Elijah. "Man of Elohim," he begged, "please have respect for my life and the lives of these 50 men, your servants. See, fire has fallen from heaven and has consumed the first two captains and all their men, but now have respect for my life." The messenger of Yahweh said to Elijah, "Go down with him, do not be afraid of him." So Elijah got up and went down with him to the king. He told the king, "This is what Yahweh says. Is it because there is no Elohim in Israel for you to consult, that you have sent messengers to consult Baal-zebub, the Elohim of Ekron? Because you have done this, you will never leave the bed you are lying on. You will certainly die." So he died, according to the word of Yahweh that Elijah had spoken.
King Ahaziah had broken his back. He wanted to know if he was going to recover. And so he sent for word to a neighboring Elohim. The word, of course, means powerful one. He sent messengers to get a medical prognosis from a neighboring Elohim, presumably because he had heard that the powerful one of Ekron was good at medical prognostics. But apparently, when either Yahweh or Elijah, the messenger of Yahweh, or the messenger who communicates on Yahweh's behalf to Elijah, when they get wind of this, Yahweh is very offended and says, "Because you've consulted the wrong Elohim, I'm going to make sure you die." That's really the nub of the story. What kind of person would treat a wounded man that way? It's the way Yahweh does. Not only that, but he incinerates 100 people when they are sent as part of the king's inquiry into the matter. Just like that. These soldiers hadn't done anything wrong. These are 100 innocent people in the service of the king who Yahweh dispenses with, just like that. Tell me, what is the religious imperative from this story? Never question. Never go to another doctor. Never think for yourself. Never inquire into what process led to something that seems utterly unjust. What is the religious imperative from this story? Is there a positive moral of the story we can extract from this? I think if the agenda of the whole canon is to get us to love and worship Yahweh, this story is a fly in the ointment. That's why I take it to be part of an earlier tradition, a story that was originally there for another reason before this overlay of Yahwist monotheism came along in the final redaction. It's been included because it's already part of the cultural memory, even though the story itself doesn't serve the overarching agenda. It is an inconvenient story, an inconvenient vestige of cultural memory.
1 Kings 14:22. Judah did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. By the sins they committed, they stirred up his jealous anger more than their fathers had done. They also set up for themselves high places, sacred stones, and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. There were even male shrine prostitutes in the land. The people engaged in all the detestable practices of the nations that Yahweh had driven out before the Israelites. 2 Kings 17:10. From every watchtower to every fortified city, they built themselves high places in every place they lived. They set up sacred stones and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. At every high place, they burned incense, as the nations whom Yahweh had driven out before them had done. They did wicked things that provoked Yahweh to anger. They worshipped idols, though Yahweh had said, "You shall not do this." Yahweh warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and seers, "Turn from your evil ways, observe my commands and decrees, in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your fathers to obey, and that I delivered to you through my servants the prophets." But they would not listen, and were as stiff-necked as their fathers, who did not trust in Yahweh, their Elohim. They rejected his decrees and the covenant he had made with their fathers and the warnings he had given them. They followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. They imitated the nations around them, even though Yahweh had ordered them, "Do not do as they do." And they did the things Yahweh had forbidden them to do. They forsook all the commands of Yahweh their God and made for themselves two idols cast in the shape of calves and an Asherah pole. They bowed down to all the starry hosts and they worshipped Baal. They sacrificed their sons and daughters in the fire. They practiced divination and sorcery and sold themselves to do evil in the eyes of Yahweh, provoking him to anger. And this is written as it being Yahweh speaking to his people. "Long ago you broke off your yoke and tore off your bonds. You said, 'I will not serve you.' Indeed, on every high hill and under every spreading tree, you lay down as a prostitute." And in Jeremiah 3:6, "During the reign of Josiah, Yahweh said to me, 'Have you seen what faithless Israel has done? She has gone up on every high hill and under every spreading tree and has committed adultery there.'" What's interesting about these passages is that the writers of 1 and 2 Kings and Jeremiah are recording what Jewish religious practice looked like in the 8th to 7th centuries BCE. It did not look like Yahwist monotheism. Both writers tell us that on every high hill and under every green spreading tree, from every fortified town to every garrison, installations were there to Asherah and to the other members of the starry host, the Seva Hashemayim. If you enjoy exploring the kind of topics that we explore on The Fifth Kind, on the Paul Wallace Channel, and in my Eden series, then Ancient Knowledge Academy is the learning community for you. A learning community for people who are exploring questions of human origins, human potential, and our place in the cosmos. We've been told ancient texts about the gods are just myths. Close encounters and anomalous experiences are just fantasy. And ancient wisdom is just irrelevant. But what if the knowledge of our ancestors is not just a reservoir of information about the past, but a roadmap to a better and bigger human experience? Ancient Knowledge Academy is an opportunity for more intentional community, more immersive learning, and a chance to connect with researchers and truth seekers from all around the world. And I will keep our feet on the ground as we explore these stretching topics. And with every subject that we bring to the courses and modules at the Academy, I will always take us to ancestral wisdom and ancient knowledge, believing that what we have in indigenous story and ancestral narratives are resources not just to understand the past, but to understand ourselves in a truer light and equip ourselves for life in the 21st century. Courses at the Academy will include all new material, audio, video, and written resources, and live face-to-face elements so that we can make this learning journey together and in real time. And the Academy enables me to connect more closely with more people who are motivated to make a paradigm-shifting journey and transform their lives. Are you ready? Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today. Now, the Tseva HaShemayim, we often translate as the heavenly host. We could equally translate it as airborne armies or sky fleet. Whichever way you translate it, it's to the plurality of Elohim, plural powerful beings honored in the 8th to 7th century BCE. And in particular, of course, we have figurines created or poles created to commemorate Asherah, this female entity honored with bringing the gift of agriculture and food and civilization to the ancestors of the Jewish people. So here we have a record of what was the cultural practice of the tribes of Israel, the tribes of Judah at that time. It was not what Jeremiah thought it should be. He thought it should be Yahwist monotheism, but it was something else. And so we've got some layers to the story here, because Jeremiah the character thinks there should be no memory of these other entities. Jeremiah the narrative voice would rather we didn't know anything about Asherah and the Tseva HaShemayim. But the authors of these books have guaranteed we will never forget the Tseva HaShemayim, the plural powerful beings, Asherah being among them. And so in order to accommodate this very unwelcome memory of ancient cultural practice, the writers have to express a value concerning it. How do the writers do this? Well, they do it using value language and by adding some other details. So they have to acknowledge that the people of Israel, the people of Judah at that time, did not remember the reign of Yahweh as something positive. They remembered it as something negative. And that they remembered Asherah positively. He has to acknowledge this. He has to acknowledge that it was in every place they lived that they honored Asherah. But now he has to add something to make us think this is terrible. He calls these figures idols. He calls this practice harlotry. He calls it idolatry. He associates it with killing children. He associates it with all kinds of other awful things, he says, detestable things that Yahweh doesn't like, but he never names them. And by stacking these other things alongside the commemoration of Asherah, he invites us to see the commemoration of Asherah in the same light. Oh, well, that must be idolatry. That must be harlotry. That must be unfaithfulness. That must be as bad as sacrificing your children in the fire. That must be bad as the worst kind of apostasy. You can see how the writer is wanting us to take this memory that he can't extinguish, but see it in association with very negative and bad things. And the archaeological record would surely confirm this. Because archaeologically, we have evidence for the commemoration of Asherah as being widely prevalent. Figurines of Asherah being the most commonly found religious artifacts across the Levant from that period, the 8th to 7th centuries BCE. We have evidence of these commemorations in the figurines, in the places for incense burning, in the carrying of bread cakes and carvings of people doing exactly this. So we do have evidence for the inconvenient bit of the story. On every high hill, under every green tree, from every fortified town to every garrison. But what we don't have any evidence of is all the negative things that the writers want us to associate with the commemoration of Asherah. We don't have archaeological evidence of human sacrifice or of temple prostitution. These are things without support other than in the words of the writers. The very least we can say is that it was most certainly the agenda of the writers to make us think negatively about something that was practiced and viewed positively in the 8th to 7th centuries BCE. And so once again, we can see that we have an inconvenient cultural memory that has to be included, but then a spin added to it so that we will move away from it thinking, well, that was bad, wasn't it? We should be good Yahwist monotheists, shouldn't we? And so I think we have three examples of stories that when you ask, what did the writer just tell us happened? The brute facts of the story are deeply inconvenient to the overarching agenda of getting us to love and worship Yahweh. But they've had to include them because they're part of the cultural memory, but they're going to try and put a spin on them so that they don't fight against the actual take-home message that the writer wants us to go home with. So let me ask you this. If these are not invented stories, if these are not moral stories, if these are not fables created to bring a religious message or a moral message, then what are they? And if they are memories of something inconvenient, what are they memories of? Are they memories of the transcendent source of the cosmos or of something else? These beings that made up the sky fleet, the Tzeva HaShemayim, what were they if they were not Almighty God? What were the Elohim of Ekron and Asherah if they were not Almighty God? Who and what were these beings? What are we to think? There are cultural stories all around the world that say that in the deep past there was a period when our ancestors lived alongside powerful non-human others. And there were glorious and happy aspects to that experience, and there were deeply disturbing aspects to that experience too. Did all these cultures around the world coincidentally invent the same story? Stories that do not aggrandize their kings or their ancestors or their elders or even the gods. Stories that would seem to be very inconvenient and yet have been curated from age to age. I believe when you take the Bible out of its bubble and read the Elohim stories alongside the Babylonian stories of Anunnaki, alongside the Bianili stories of the Tingir, alongside Assyrian stories of the genies and their ancient carvings, when you listen to it alongside the stories of feathered serpents out of Egypt, out of Mesopotamia, out of Mesoamerica, out of China, there is a very coherent picture that emerges of human beings living alongside powerful non-human others. And that is the plain reading of the texts in the Bible. In order to interpret these as stories of God, you have to accept the violence and immorality of their behavior and call it holy. Are you willing to do that?
Take a moment to read these scriptures, which are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of unjust laws and mass kings at the hands of just one of the Elohim, the one named Yahweh. Thank you.
If you worship a God who's xenophobic, you have to justify xenophobia and become xenophobic yourself. If you worship a God who is misogynistic, you have to justify that misogyny and become misogynistic yourself. Worship a God who's violent and invades other people's countries. This is the distortion, and we have 2,000 years of imperial and colonial history confirming that's exactly the case. These stories are not stories about God. They are about something completely different. We are being told about something else, contact with a different kind of entity.
As to what the entities in these stories really are, that's the question of all my work in the world of paleo contact.
Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today.